going.
Move that up there. So the biochemistry department was in the medical school, which was not unusual, I don't believe, at that time.
That's right. As I said, there was a biochemical course the previous years, so-called Bio 3, at the university, but they hadn't given it in several years. So the biochemistry course was at the medical school. Now, Hastings himself was a PhD. Interestingly, we can come back to that later. He got his degree at Columbia. And in 1918 or 1920, around then, and he was supported by the Public Health Service. He was, I think, in the Public Health Service as an assistant sanitary chemist during the war, assigned to Columbia. So he had, he likes to say, it was really the first. I guess it was right after he got his degree. No, he got his degree, I think, in Michigan. I'm not sure. Anyway, he worked at Columbia, and he got his first. I could check on that. He got his. He said he was really the first postdoctoral fellow that the Public Health Service had, which, as you know, was a much bigger program later. So then he went to Rockefeller. Then he went to Chicago, and then he came to Harvard. And as I say, and he was very interested, and I have to emphasize that again and again, in the teaching, and in the teaching of the medical students, with the idea that they would be using biochemistry in their thinking in the care of patients. So that was a very good cause.
What was the second year like?
The second year is a little is a little more vague in my mind. It was very interesting in its own right, but not for relation to things we're talking about. We had a very good pathology course, both microscopic and gross. We started physical diagnosis, you know, elementary use of the stethoscope, things of that sort. A pharmacology course that was given by Otto Krier that was quite good, and he represented there again. It was sort of much better than pharmacology almost anywhere else in this country, because it was a much more dynamic pharmacology instead of the old materia medica kind of thing. We had hot lung preparations and so forth with a minimum amount of attention to, you know, how you make pills and so forth. So that was really very good. It was really much more of a physiology course. And Krier also, I think, was a most unusual person. He was assistant in Feldberg's laboratory in Germany when, at least this is the story I understand, and I'm sure it's correct, and when Feldberg was dismissed by the German government because he was Jewish, and they offered Krier the job, or Krier was next, and Krier, who was not Jewish, left the country instead of taking a job. So he was a very unusual, righteous person, and actually I got to know him a bit, because either he was unmarried at the time or his wife hadn't come over, and he used to eat in the dining room at the medical school. And as I say, he gave a course, and it included a lot of heart, lung, physiology, and so forth. But the interesting thing in the second year particularly was at Harvard you had two afternoons a week in that year at least, free for voluntary courses. And I took a voluntary course, and I took one in physical chemistry. And that was at the a department at the medical school that was very, in addition to the biochemistry department, was a very high level scientific department, and that had no, it was a little unusual because it had no teaching interactions, so that most of the students didn't even know it was there. And this, but again, because of my background at Harvard College, I knew about it. And this was the department that John Edsel was in.
Oh. Okay.
And Edwin Cohn was the chairman, and it had a number of really superb physical chemists there. I mean, it was John Edsel, Edwin Cohn, John Ferry, Unkley, and several others, superb people, and they gave a course for the for this relatively small group of medical students, probably a half dozen at most, I would think, who were interested. And and they went over all the new things that were being developed in protein chemistry, particularly abroad and so forth. And that was really very exciting. Now, I always say that I'm sorry I didn't remember more of it, and, but at John Edsel's 90th birthday, you weren't there by any chance.
No.
It was rather interesting, but this is the way science is. They point out that almost, except in the hemoglobin area, almost everything that was considered valid and important in those days in protein chemistry were is wrong. And that even some of the, you know, very definitive theories that were presented were almost ridiculous from our point of view now. Nevertheless, the ideas, the approaches were important, and some of the work, of course, the work of John Edsel on, you know, on amino acids and hemoglobin work is all, of course, very relevant. So, and a large part of it, I'm sure, is still very valid, but it's rather interesting from a historic perception that. You know, the field changed so drastically, but that was a very memorable part of the.
What was the status of knowledge of enzymes at that time?
Well, of course, this was 1939, and I think it would depend on where, what part of the world you were in. In other words, we didn't, my recollection is, we didn't, in either course did we go over enzymes particularly. And yet, on the other hand, obviously, you had the whole group in Germany, I mean, Barbara and others, developing it. And perhaps I'm showing my lack of recollection about what was covered, but I think in the physical chemical group, obviously, it was, they were proteins, not as. I don't remember any discussion of enzymes or catalytic centers or anything of that sort. Of course, it would have been hard to do if you didn't have the know-how we know now about the structure. So between both courses, it was heavily oriented to. Well, towards two things. Well, talk about biochemistry, there we had both the physical chemistry type of thing at a relatively elementary level for medical students of the interactions of blood and intermediary metabolism. I mean, this was a laboratory that Folline had been head of, and after all, this was classic, shall we say, biochemistry, namely what things go to and what gets excreted and what is significant, as you see. And in the physical, in the this voluntary course, it was the physical chemistry of proteins, and particularly hemoglobin and others. As was known at that time. I might say, going back to talking about hemoglobin, going back to chemistry 15 at Harvard College and L.J. Henderson, there's one very picturesque classroom demonstration he had that I have referred to again and again in all kinds of connections, and that is to show the interactions of blood. He brought in a wooden frame, and he had had nails around it, and he had interlocking rubber bands, and he plucked one and showed how all the others moved or vibrated or what have you, to show how you change one component in the blood or in the hemoglobin system, red cell system, and you change all kinds of other things. You just can't change one without considering the interactions. And I've used that again and again because from what we know now in proteins, you can't change one amino acids without changing the whole secondary and tertiary structure and so forth. And it's a concept that, to a large extent, is obvious, but is not usually thought of. I mean, we're much more used to the concept you may change one thing and you very, very simple things. In that connection, I might mention that I also took a very good bacteriology course that Hans Zenzer, whose name I guess you undoubtedly know, gave, and he was also a very picturesque lecturer. And John Ender's talk, Mueller talked, gave part of it, and Charlie Janeway was a section man, and so that was quite good too. But it was before the development, at least in this country, of the use of bacteria as a tool for studying metabolism. I think Mueller was starting a bit with his toxin work, but in general it was a much more classic type of bacteriology. But again, that was the classic work was very important. Apropos of what I was saying, though, about the example of the blood interactions, at that time, later people have referred to it, there was almost a different way of thinking between bacteriology and some of the other fields. Namely, and some people blame bacteriology for a change in concepts, I think incorrect, but, and that is the concept in bacteriology, one thing leads to another. You get an infection and you get a disease, and it's a different way of thinking than to thinking that one change causes changes in all kinds of parameters. But now, of course, bacteriology is an integral part of everything else we're doing, and I personally and so many people have used, obviously, bacteriology is in the forefront of everything now. Nevertheless, it was a again, it was a very nice course.
What you're saying then is that, as you mentioned, bacteriology and physiology and all of these different branches that were pretty separated. Is that true at
That's
the time?
Right. They were very separated at the time, and there was just these little glimpses of their getting together. But it was before they really got together. They were, and of course, with a bias, you would say it's biochemistry that brings them together. You see. I remember I also took a volunteer course in the very vague on genetics. It was, and it was very unsatisfying because at that time, well, just so little was known. It was, you know, sort of nothing. I think that's an understatement. There was a lot known, I'm sure, but obviously, going back to Mendel, but in terms of molecular, in thinking molecularly, obviously, there was just nothing. And so.
Wasn't genetics at that time more a study in statistics than.
That's right, yeah, very much so, you see. So, I don't remember much about it, but mainly that it was just that, and so, and how different it is, you know, now, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And in retrospect, of course, some of these areas, more was known than was taught, you mm-hmm. see, but, you know, for example, obviously, bacteriophage was around, and maybe we were told something about bacteriophage, but I certainly don't remember it. You see, and yet in retrospect, it would have been obviously a very important part. But again, of course, it was a medical school, and I think, despite the approach I'm taking in talking to you, because of my own personal interests. And I think Harvard did very well in balancing both. The fact is, a medical school is most of the people are going to go out and practice medicine. So that when you give these courses, I mean, it was much more of an emphasis on that, and I enjoyed that aspect too.
When did you start any? When did the clinical studies start?
Well, as I say, a little bit in the second half of the second year, but then mostly in the third and fourth years, when you went into the clinics. Before I come to that, though, I think one of these summers, probably the first or second year, I'm not sure. Worked for part of the time. When I say worked, in those days you did not get paid for working. Again, it was still depression period. There were no funds for students. You just, you know, volunteered. But worked with Elmer Stotes, who was working on over at the had opened a laboratory over in Waltham, part of the. I think it's probably part of the MGH now. I don't know if it was not then. And later, he was professor of biochemistry at Rochester and did some work, if I recall, on the cytochromes. But did nothing publishable. But at least got familiar with, you know, some of the techniques involved. And he was also a very stimulating person. He had also taught in Hastings. In her Hastings course, so but then, as you were asking, in the third and fourth year was completely clinical, and frankly, I enjoyed that.
I was going to ask how that must have been quite a change with all your interest in the more scientific side. Yeah. You're taking physical chemistry and
Yeah.
And then now, did you see any immediate connection between the kind of more science exposure you had and the clinical aspects?
It was much. No, it would be somewhat strained at that mm-hmm. time. Yeah, I mean, obviously, when you analyze urine, it had something. You know, I mean that, but in a very narrow sense, mm-hmm. it did. But no, basically not. But clinical medicine, I don't want to underestimate its attractiveness at this level as a student. Is very exciting. I mean, it's a problem. You have a patient, and you have a it's a black box, sort of. You mm-hmm. have to get the symptoms and figure out what the what's going on inside, what the mechanisms are. It's bad enough when you are doing even nowadays when you do a biochemical or a physiologic experiment where you can control some of your variables and you still have trouble figuring out the what's going on in the vernacular of some of our letters I reluctantly write to authors that we'll come to later, that this is a very interesting observation that you have, but it still doesn't contribute enough to our understanding of the basic mechanisms involved. And I think that's the big challenge in much of certainly internal medicine or any diagnosis, that you have a problem. And how do you figure out what's going on? And of course, there's a lot of satisfaction in curing people. You know, mm-hmm. there's no question about that. And there's a lot of satisfaction in making a good diagnosis.
Well, in reality, that's just like you've solved the problem if you've made a good diagnosis.
That's right. Well, even more than that, you solve the problem, but there's a very personal aspect. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't help but be pleased when you make somebody feel better. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm going ahead, really, when you're interning, you're doing that, but the students have a fair part in the diagnosis in the hospital, because especially at almost all schools, but they have a bright, energetic students, and they look, they can pick up things that even the more experienced person doesn't. They spend more time, because it's all very. So I don't want to underestimate my interest or the interest that one should have in medicine. Harvard was particularly good from this point of view because they had certain departments like the Thorndike Laboratory at the Boston City that was a very high grade scientific departments. And this was true of most of the hospitals, and this was, I think, not as true now. I think this is true really almost all over all the medical schools, partly because of grants, you might say, are doing good, I mean, scientific work. But at that point, most of the, you're getting uncomfortable. Did you
no,
want
no, to, I'm just, yeah.
Most of the, most medical schools in the country did not have this approach. I think it was much more of a practical school. In fact, there were certain people who even encouraged that and said that, you know, that the science should be done at the university. But fortunately, that wasn't the case. I think there are certain schools that I mean, Columbia, Harvard, Yale, that were that pushed the scientific approach to medicine, and I think that made a big difference. And I think it's one reason why, well, there are any number of reasons, but why so many of my classmates went into, well, not full-time non-academic work, but all of them were not full, very few left clinical medicine completely. But I think, I don't have the figures handy, but I think over, could look it up, we can check it, but over 60 or 70% of my class had academic, or 80% had academic appointments along with their clinical practice. And I think we account for a very large percent of the, there were quite a few deans and professors of medicine. I think about half my class were really up in that category. I mean, as I say, I'll check it for the
yes.
But this is not really irrelevant because it was an academic academic background. On the just to be anecdotal, but and also to be, I'm still pleased at it to show how the satisfaction you get with a good diagnosis. I tell this story, and it's my punchline is not true, but I can say it this way. If someone asked me why did I go into biochemistry and didn't go into clinical medicine, I'd tell them the following story. When I was a third-year medical student, I was at Boston City Hospital, and William Castle, whose name you must know, if Castle and Line, if you know, was the attending, senior attending, and Dr. Michael John was junior attending. And a man came in. The interesting thing, parenthetically, of medicine is you still remember 50 years later all your cases, a lot of your cases. But a man came in with a mass in his abdomen. And as the usual thing, the medical student writes up the, takes a history, writes up provisional diagnoses. And with, I went to the library, and with naivety, I made a very rare diagnosis. Really, in retrospect, unjustified, but I said it was a pseudocyst of the pancreas due to occlusion of the foramen of Winslow. Well, of course, you don't know the anatomy, you can't explain that, but what that is a, you think it's a pancreatic cyst, but it's due to the fact that the foramen of Winslow, which is the exit from that part of the cavity, gets blocked. So the junior attending, when I presented it, took me to the window, and they still had outside electric and telephone wires in Boston City Hospital, and said, "See that bird over there? It might be a Roman eagle, but it's probably a sparrow." Well, when they operated, it turned out it was a Roman eagle, that I was right. And, well, what I'm saying is that part is true, but what I'm saying is not completely true is Dr. Castle took me aside, obviously was impressed by it, and said, "Look, you've had it. You make one of those diagnoses in a lifetime." So what I like to say is that, well, if I made my diagnosis, there's no use going on in clinical medicine. So I went into biochemistry. Anyway, that's just a little humor along the way.